Welcome to Canada Homeschools, the dose of inspiration and encouragement for Canadian homeschoolers. Canada Homeschools features interviews with homeschool group organizers, resource suppliers, and conversations with everyday homeschoolers just like you, all from a Canadian perspective. I'm your host, Rowan Atkinson. I'd like to thank you for joining me. Now let's get started.
In 400 meters.
Are we there yet?
In 100 meters.
You have reached your destination.
Well, I'm so pleased to welcome Stephanie Sewell back to the Canada Homeschools podcast. Stephanie is an independent educational coach and consultant who helps students and parents with education. To hear more about that and her homeschooling journey, go back to season 3, episode 9, The Importance of Connection in Education. Today, we're going to be talking about the concept of deschooling in more detail and also about unschooling and self-directed learning for children, teens, and their parents. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you very much. I'm really glad to be back with you today.
It's my pleasure, believe me. So let's start with deschooling. Home educators often mention the importance of deschooling when you are transitioning, for example, from public education to homeschooling. But I understand that the concept is actually much broader than that. So could you please tell us what deschooling is and why it is important?
I'm so glad you started with that question because I think it's really the place to start. And we usually don't start there because we start with a decision to homeschool. And we think we know what homeschooling should look like. And it's often only as you start actually talking to homeschoolers or things are not going as you expected them to, then you start finding out about deschooling. The other reason I think it's such an important question is because I don't believe that deschooling is just for people who are coming out of school. I think deschooling is for anybody who's ready to shift the way they and their family think about and live education. So it's pretty all-encompassing. So if anybody wants to find this, go to my Facebook page. I have a post there from somebody had interviewed their son who was 16 and he was talking about deschooling, and I meant to find all the names associated with this and I forgot to do it before we came on today. But he talks about deschooling as being the process of refinding your creativity. And I think that's such a great way to explain it. Our conventional mindset is that we learn what is taught to us, that in order to make sure that kids learn what they need to learn to be educated or to live in society, we need them to be taught a certain curriculum in a certain order. It varies a bit from one country to the next or one province to the next, but there's, you know, the three R's and it's fairly standard. And that's how we think learning needs to look. So to me, deschooling is taking all of that apart and getting back to the core of what it is to be human. So that involves things like routines. You don't need to think of Monday to Friday as being learning time or school time or homeschooling time. Monday to Friday is just Monday to Friday. It's going to be defined probably by somebody in the family having a job, but that's family. And that's an important, that is the core, is how we live our lives. That we can start from those givens in our lives rather than external things that don't have to be there. Deschooling is also the breaking open the mindset of how we learn things. So, and we mentioned this in our previous episode, think about how a baby learns something. You know, when that baby's born, you're in a pretty pure state of not needing to deschool because you are so attuned to what the baby is asking. You're so confident in the baby's ability to, you know, do what they let you know what they need and do what they need. You know, as they start to show signs that they're ready to roll over, like we'll notice that and get excited and support them. But we're not going to say, oh, you're ready to roll over? Okay, well, you put this arm down then and you do this. And so we're very attuned to that learning as it naturally is arising from the person. So de-schooling is getting back to that place. How do you do it? Well, sometimes it means you're not going to do anything or think about anything to do with quote unquote learning for a long time. A lot of homeschoolers will say, if you're coming out of school, you need to de-school for a month for every year that you've been in school, which is a helpful formula. And I think it's also important to say, well, even if you've got a child who's in grade one, so you only need to de-school for 1 month, but the parent needs to de-school for like 20 months. So it's that sense of it takes time. It's deeply entrenched in us, all of these school-like thoughts. So letting go of curriculum, letting go of schedules that are specific to learning, schooling, education is a really important thing. And that's a time when you can start kind of exercising that muscle of noticing when kids are just learning. Like you notice when they were ready to learn to roll over or ready to learn to talk. Notice when they're starting to do something that shows that they're ready to learn how to bake cookies or how to read that recipe for themselves. That noticing is a really important way of shifting our mindset into more of a de-schooling mode, which allows us to initiate our own learning.
I think that kind of covered it a little bit, but because as parents, unless we were unschooled, but that was quite rare in my generation, and I don't want to offend any unschooler, but in my generation, it was an unschooler is someone doing a very bad job of homeschooling. But because there wasn't the movement wasn't very well formed or well known.
Yep.
And so most people were just transferring school to home.
Yep.
And then having a classical education or, you know, a very academic education, more intentional, run by curriculum, that sort of thing. So they didn't really understand necessarily the concepts that we're understanding more now, or that you're explaining.
Right.
So for someone like me, who, even though I was homeschooled for part of my education, I still loved my public education, and I'm very academic myself. So I excelled academically, and I did 4 years of university after that. So there's a lot of institutionalized learning that has, you know, taken place into my brain, for example. So can you compare or maybe explain more thoroughly or contrast institutionalized education and self-directed learning for us?
Yeah. So I'm going to start with something that is equally important for de-schooling as for this notion of contrasting the two.
First, can I just say, I do not think unschooling is just bad homeschooling. I'm just saying that that was kind of the prevailing opinion or thought, like, you know, almost 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm a homeschooler. So,
but I think
I'm not saying that that is my opinion now.
It's good to bring it up, though, because I think that there's definitely still a sense of that among the broader community of people who think about homeschooling, unschooling, whatever. And part of it, I think, is the term, right? Like unschooling is like we're undoing or we're not doing that. So we're doing the opposite.
Right.
So if you think of school as learning and teaching, then we're doing the opposite, which is we're not learning and we're not teaching. So it's easy to understand it in that way. It's, of course, not accurate. And that's fine. Like it's a question of redefining it or helping people to see that. But it also brings up something which I think is really important, which is the process of de-schooling to me means you're getting back to the core about how are you going to choose to move forward through your childhood, or how is your child going to choose, supported by you, to move through their childhood. You might choose to go to school, and you may be completely deschooled, like you're thinking completely clearly, independently, you're connected to what you want, and you choose to go to school. And you could say that you at school are actually an unschooler, because you're choosing to be there. You're choosing to have that experience. The fact that you're there by choice means that you're having a different experience than somebody who's there because they have to be there or they think they have to be there. You might, as an unschooler sitting in a school desk, you might be more willing to say, I don't feel like going today, I'm going to stay home. You might be willing to say, I have something more important to do than this homework. I'm going to, you know, have a conversation with my teacher to explain to them, not ask permission, but explain to them that my values were different for that time. So I think that's really important to recognize that once you get to that core, you might choose to go to school. You might choose to go to school some of the time. You might choose to go to a particular kind of school. You might go to a learning center. You might go to a co-op. You might choose to stay home all the time and work on your own stuff. Anything is possible and fair and good and wonderful, as long as you're motivating it, you're directing it. And that's why, personally, I use the term self-directed learning or self-directed education much more than I use unschooling. They have slightly different meanings, but I find functionally self-directed is easier to kind of wrap your head around it.
It's actually a positive term.
Exactly.
Because you're not putting a sort of a negative prefix on the word schooling. It's an active term. Yeah.
And there's, you know, worldwide, there's a wonderful self-directed learning, self-directed education kind of community that's of experts of parents that's emerging. Jana Clements in South Africa is creating, as we speak, a new network that has wonderful opportunities for courses and connecting with others. And so it's a great world to get involved with and to realize that you might consider yourself a family that self-directs the education or unschools, and you might be following curriculum, but you're choosing to do it. And you know that you can choose not to do it or choose to do a different curriculum. You're in the driver's seat. You're not doing something just because you think and feel you have to. So going back to your question about comparing and contrasting institutionalized education and self-directed learning, I think that's the key thing, is institutionalized education is kind of top down. It's being imposed on, it's being done to. And for those who are listening, I talk with my hands a lot. So imagine my hand showing that. It's top down, whereas self-directed learning is rippling out from the core of you. And as you ripple out, you connect in with other people. You might connect with an institution at different times. You connect with nature. You connect with books. You connect with everything. It's coming from you and rippling out in a way that aligns with who you are and always has you at the core. It's what I talk about with my tagline of own your learning, own your life. Self-directed learning is you're owning it. You own the beginning. You own the core. You own the seed. And it grows from there.
And I'm glad that you mentioned about the use of curriculum in self-directed learning, because the concept of unschooling or self-directed learning is often interpreted in such a way that the parent is giving like no direction to the learner, or that the learner only has to do what they feel like doing and not do what they don't feel like doing. But how should this play out in reality for a younger child who, for example, needs to learn how to read and perform mathematical operations in order to learn whatever it is that interests them? Like, you can be really interested in a topic, but if you're not sitting down and actually doing the work of learning how to read, you're not going to get very far in learning about the topic.
So when you've really come to that core of self, a self-directed learner who wants to learn about topic X in a book is going to be okay with the fact that they need to learn to read in order to read that book. And they will do what they need to do to learn to read. And that's what we see over and over again in school. So in unschooling contexts or in Sudbury schools, kids often don't learn to read till they're 10, 11, 12 years old. And usually what prompts them to learn to read is they need to read a book. They have a desire to read a book. They want to join a Minecraft server where people are communicating in text. So there's something that they want to do and they need to learn to read to do it. So as an aside to that, one of the areas or the one of the ways to de-school that we often don't talk about is our common concept of how long it takes to learn something. We're so used to thinking that learning to read is something that takes a couple of years with a lot of pre-learning letters and all of that. What we see in the communities where people are learning to read when they choose to is that it can take a couple of days. And that's when we start to realize that all along we weren't seeing this, but they're surrounded by text. There's songs about letters. There's so many ways that they're starting to experience text and the notions of reading and maybe even reading without realizing they're reading. And when they get to a point where it's like, I need to do this, all of that comes flooding into their process of pulling it together in order to be able to open that book about dinosaurs and read it. And it can happen almost magically. Yana Clemens talks about that in some of her videos, and she describes that process beautifully.
I do realize that pushing kids to read when they're 3, 4, 5, like even their brain development seems to connect with reading better from even age 6 onward. And some cultures don't even have their kids in sort of formal institutionalized education until they're 6. They don't bother with kindergarten stuff.
Yep.
So I do understand that, but I just can't help but wonder if some listeners might be extremely uncomfortable with the idea of their child not learning how to read until they were 10 or 11. Like, I'm just going to be very honest. I would be very uncomfortable just letting my children not know how to read by the age of 10 years old, unless they had like a very specific learning difficulty that made the process more difficult. I'd be very uncomfortable with that. I'm just being honest, and I think my listeners might be feeling that way, or some others will absolutely be like, here, here.
And no, I think
might be like, that's not okay.
And I think a majority of people would probably feel that's not okay. I'm not comfortable with that. How will they function? And of course, if they're in school, they won't function. So then you come into, well, go back to that core. If you're choosing to go to school, then you will need to learn to read by age 6 or 7, because that's part of your choice of being in school, is learning that skill. So so if you're a family that's not in school and you're choosing to, you know, let reading emerge when it emerges naturally, there will be times when there's going to be an obstacle. And that might be what prompts your child to learn to read, or it might not be. Your child might avoid something because it's a reading context and it might feel super uncomfortable to you. And those are some of the most difficult moments as parents in that context of being an unschooling or self-directed learning family. And we have those contexts in other contexts as well, where we don't know if we should like make our kid go and do whatever it is. So one thing that's really important with that is recognizing that with all aspects of being a parent, we tend to seek knowledge, advice, reassurance around us. Maybe sometimes it's books, podcasts, you know, grandparents, if that's what works for you, communities, whatever it is. So if you're going to do this unschooling, I'm going to let my kid learn to read when they're ready thing, it's really important to surround yourself with others who have that experience. Because we need to know that it's not irresponsible as parents. We need to know that. Like no parent wants to do badly by their child. And this is a big one. So that's a big part of it, I think, is just to know that it's okay to say you have to learn to read because, like in our case, it was my husband is Polish. Our kids were going to go to Polish Saturday morning Polish school because we wanted that for them culturally. When we got there, we found out that as of grade one, Saturday morning Polish school was extremely academic. They did workbooks. So in order for Oliver to go to Saturday morning Polish school, he needed to learn to read. So that's when I started gently introducing him to learning to read stuff. So there's all of those things we need to understand. What is our context? You know, with anything to do with homeschooling, unschooling, schooling, as a parent, you know, you might lie awake at night thinking, okay, I know what the best education setting is for my kid. It's going to be this, 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 and this. And then you look around and go, oh, but that doesn't exist where we live. I really want to homeschool, but there's no other family that homeschools for 30 miles. You know, maybe that means you don't homeschool because you, whatever. Like, so understanding your context is really important for any aspect of parenting. And in the case of things like learning to read, if your context is your kid is going to be the only one and every child activity in your area is focused around reading, and you and your child choose not to put yourselves in that situation, then maybe they will learn to read in advance of when they would have done otherwise. Sorry, I'm rambling now, but...
No, this is really good because I think it's getting down to some of the concerns that people could have about self-directed learning. And another concern I think could be, and I know I didn't ask you these questions in advance, but okay. It's a conversation and that's what I love about it. What if your child isn't really motivated by anything? What if they're kind of immature and would rather seek their own pleasure and just play video games all day or run around outside all day? What do you do then? If it's all what's coming from within them, or is it? How does that work? Just asking honest questions.
But these are the questions that I get asked when I work with families. So this is great. This is like, we need to ask these questions and have these conversations. So I'm going to say two things to the video game example. One is, if we as parents are looking at what the kids are doing and thinking it's not enough or they should be doing something else or having those kinds of thoughts, which of course we do as parents all the time in all kinds of contexts, we can try going down deeper into the core, like get into the center of that rippling out thing. So what do we truly want for our child? And this is often what I do at the beginning of working with parents is like, we'll make a heart on my paper in behind and put the child's name at the center and think, what do you want for that child? And it's always things like to be happy, to be independent, to be, you know, able to know their own mind, to be safe, healthy. It's never to be able to, you know, read War and Peace or whatever. Like, it's those, the most base things that we want for our children don't typically have to do with academics. That's like on the next level out. So if we come back to that and we say, okay, so that child who's playing video games all day, are they happy? Are they independent? Yeah. And then it comes into trusting. Do we trust that at the moment when they're not liking the way it is, something in them is going to kick in and inspire them to start making a change? You know, if we look at the baby that's lying on its back, do we trust that something in them is going to, at some point, make them start trying to roll onto their front? Or do we have to say, today you're going to learn to roll onto your front? So it's that trust. And it's really hard with video games because, you know, they're indoors, they're on the screen. Like, there's so many red flags with video games.
It's very hard. It also can affect their brain development.
Yes.
In certain directions.
So I'm not an expert on video games. When I get into that conversation, send people to Peter Gray. He writes a lot about it. Judy Arnell also writes a lot about it. And what I say is, I believe that underlying all of this is, what is your routine as a family? What is your rhythm as a family? What are your values as a family? So if your family routine is, the internet actually is off between 9 and 3, and a lot of unschooling families do that because they want to create a space where we learn things in ways that aren't screen related. Maybe that, you know, so then the video games just don't happen during that time. That can be seen as like a sneaky way of controlling, or, and what I hope is that it's really a question of looking at, who are we as a family? We want to have some time where our default isn't a screen, and parents have to be ready to invest in that as well. And then we create that space. And then when they are able to go to the screen, it's up to us to learn to find ways to step back. And there's a story that I'll tell, because I think it's so helpful with this. A teen that I worked with, and she talked about when she first left school, she spent so much time scrolling through TikTok. And she said at first, it was just mindless, like hours, and her dad was, you know, threatening to cut off the internet, like, you know, the whole thing. And over time, she realized that when she was scrolling through with her body, her mind was starting to wander. It was getting bored. And the next step that she realized was happening was, her mind was starting to think about things and wonder about things. And then at a certain point, she realized that she was starting to choose which TikTok channels, whatever they are on TikTok, she was going to, based on what she was thinking and wondering about. And then she realized that she was actually starting to use TikTok as a learning tool. So that happened because she went through her own process. So I think that it's an example of how trusting in our innate human process can really work. The caveat is that the jury's out on how addictive these things are and to what extent we are being taken away from our human processes by being on them. So that's my caveat, and I'm not an expert in that, so I can't comment on that. But I've seen, you know, this type of experience that she described of getting bored. I've seen that happen in many, many families. And I've also seen what is our family value? You know, it isn't to have the internet on all the time. And that just creates space so that when you do go to Minecraft and you're on it for hours and hours, yes, there's lots of good that comes out of Minecraft. And on some level, you also know when your body is feeling squirmy and you start to realize you can get up.
Yeah, I like Minecraft because they're building something, they're creating something, and often they're with their friends building something together. And so they're connecting. Yeah. So I'm not anti-video game. I guess I'm picturing, you know, in the context of the question, is picturing a child who doesn't maybe know what's best for themselves, really, like maybe they should get out and play and not be in front of the screen for too long and that kind of thing. And so as parents, I guess we need to create more of an atmosphere, like our family goes for a walk after lunch, or because
that's, it's being well-rounded,
I guess, is a value that I have.
Yep.
Even though in self-directed learning, you might not be so well-rounded because you might become a specialist.
Yep. So yeah, I think it's that idea.
Complicated.
It is. And it's that idea of family routines. And also, you know, most people who homeschool don't spend, you know, they don't sit at home all the time. They're participating in homeschool co-ops or outings or whatever it is. So if you've got, you know, co-op is on Thursdays and that's outside, well, you're not going to be spending Thursday on the screen. You'll be spending it outside. So it's like a parallel way. If, you know, if you're feeling like, well, there's a lot of defaulting to being on the screen, then in parallel, what are things that you might set up that create different opportunities?
Okay, I think that's helpful. I think that helps us to understand the concept a little more kind of practically.
Yeah, I'm just looking at a note that I had made as well. In terms of, you know, the idea of learning to read and mathematical operations and things like that, I was just wanting to share that, you know, sometimes we can offer to help or model the idea of reading and things like that. It's a really interesting balance, and you can see it, that sometimes you'll think like, oh, they expressed an interest in such and such, and you're like, yeah, okay, like, you know, let's sign you up for whatever it is. And sometimes that act of making it real squashes their desire to do it.
Oh, I saw that so many times with ours, even though I wouldn't call myself an unschooler, but you know, you do want, you're thinking about their life, and so you do want to provide them with the resources that they need to pursue an interest, and but their interests kept changing like every few months. So, you know, if someone wanted to be a veterinary technician, all of a sudden they were so interested in the animals, and so you'd buy the horse anatomy coloring book and you'd get them in 4-H, and they would, you know, put all these ways. And maybe it's from being kind of goal oriented myself, if I, you know, the steps you take to get somewhere. And so, and then they would be no longer interested, and I'd have to come up with a whole other, you know, educational resources for whatever the next thing was that they were interested in. And then sometimes they would even imply that it was me pushing them in the direction of what they had brought up, but it wasn't at all. It was their idea. I was just facilitating it. And so, yeah,
that's a really difficult thing.
They do change their minds.
Yeah. So two things. One is it's often when we ask questions, it can help. Like, you know, would you, there is this 4-H thing. Are you interested in signing up for it? And accepting if the answer is no. And that's really hard. So there's a lot of, sorry, these are all huge topics in and of themselves. But so there's a bit of that. Like, how can we engage in a way that allows us to facilitate, but still has them in the driver's seat? That's really important. And then to recognize that, you know, if their interests go from like dinosaurs to horses to this to that, the interests are changing, but that's just the manifestation of what's actually happening. What they're actually doing is maybe realizing that, you know, animals exist, and that different animals have different, I don't know, whatever qualities. Or if it's from like all the different types of dinosaurs to cars, maybe their brain of like starting to categorize and sort stuff, you know, everything that we painfully learned in like grade 9 biology, their brain is doing that, is realizing, oh, things are divided up and there's different subcategories. That's what's actually happening in their brain. And they're just trying it on in different ways. You know, I see it with my son, like he was so into birds for a long time. And then he was completely not into birds anymore. It was like, don't even talk to me about birds. But he started to really get into mountain biking. And so now it's, and I can see it, like that part of his brain that was inspired and excited by birds shows up in the mountain biking and is showing up now in the engineering degree. So those are just outward manifestations. And we might not know what the common thread is until later, but there will be a common thread when they do flit around from one thing to another.
And I flit around from one thing to another. Because this week I could be obsessed with permaculture orchards, and next week I could be obsessed with prepping, and then next week I could be obsessed with something else. So it's lifelong learning, I think.
And it's trusting from us to them. It's trusting that we don't know what the sense of it is yet, but that's okay. We just trust that. And that's where the deschooling shows up, right? Because deschooling is never done. It's an ongoing thing. And
learning
we'll have
is
things.
Never done.
Yep.
I would be very sad if learning ended. I think I would end.
Yep, absolutely. Agreed.
And it's not a failure if they're not interested in something anymore. It's actually a success because they know who they are and what they want to pursue and what interests and inspires them.
And we want, and how awesome for them to get to learn to value that and to be okay with that when they're little, or when they're living under our roofs, you know, that actually has applicability for the screen stuff as well. Like if they only get to spend as much time as they want on TikTok once they move out, and they're also trying to deal with being a university student or paying rent or whatever it is, that's a lot to deal with all at once. Whereas if they've already had a chance to go like get lost in TikTok or whatever it is, and come out the other side while they're still being held safely by their family, maybe that's a good outcome.
Yeah, that's some good food for thought. One of your specialties seems to be the education of teens. Can you talk to us about this? And what does self-directed learning look like that in the teenage years? You have talked quite a bit about it, but maybe there are a couple of specific things that you want to mention. And why do you think that it's particularly beneficial for teens to have self-directed learning? And you're welcome to mention your tagline again, because I think it's very appropriate to this question.
Yeah, so yeah, we've definitely touched on a lot of aspects of this question already. One of the most important ones, I think, is what I just mentioned, which was that idea of like practicing for being an adult. You know, when you're in a space where nobody's going to tell you what your limits are, how awesome to get to practice that while somebody's still putting the roof over your head and putting food in front of you. So that's a big part of self-directed learning for me, for teens. But that's not the academic part, typically. So I think that the self-directed learning in the academics is the more you can own what you're doing and own your interests, your desire to do it, to choose to do it or not, you're so much more ready to do it at a university level or to move into adulthood. We infantilize teens so much in a school context. You know, you have 16-year-olds who have to raise their hand and ask to go to the bathroom. Like, that's nonsense. These are people who in other times or in other societies would be raising families. And they're ready to do that in some ways. So for high school age kids, the more they can be practicing their adult muscle, the better. So self-directing is that. If they can say, you know, for my son, it looked like him starting to realize that he wanted to go to university. Him starting to realize, well, it's probably going to be like engineering or computers or something like that. Okay, so what are some of the things I'm going to have to know? Well, I'm going to have to know some math. Okay, so how do I want to do that? Well, it's probably going to be pretty straightforward if I just find out what my friend's doing at school and buy the same textbook. Okay, let's do it. So that's kind of what self-directed learning looked like for him with math. And then, you know, I helped him until my brain was not remembering anymore. And I was like, I would so much rather to pay someone to help you than remember this myself, which is really important to know as a homeschool parent or unschool parent to a teenager. You do not have to be the one who remembers the content. There are so many other ways to bring content specialists in who can help them learn stuff. So self-directed starts to look like that. It starts to look like understanding what opportunities are around you. You know, again, to go back to an Oliver example, he was interested in history and current events, and just starting to kind of play with having conversations about that stuff with his friends. And we had had a music teacher who used to come to the house when he was younger, who would always stand at the door for an hour before he left talking about history and current events. And I wound up talking to Oliver and saying, well, what if we approach this person to see if he would want to do something with a group of homeschoolers? And thus was born 2 or 3 years of amazing history, current events, seminar types of things, which informed the way Oliver looks at the world today. It was magical. And that's an example of self-directed learning, where there was this little like seed of something. You look around, what are the possibilities? He could also have signed up for a history course online, but this was an option. So for them to know that they can find ways to learn that are conventional or not, and that their creativity is the only limit to that. How awesome to get to figure that out as a teenager. And like Oliver decided to go to school for grade 12, you might just decide to do that. And you're directing yourself into that thing. Because for him, some of it was, I feel like I need to learn how to be a student who's juggling multiple courses, has to be there at 9 a.m. Like, if I'm going to do university, I kind of need to learn some of these skills. I need to learn how to take a test. I need to learn how to learn from a teacher that I don't like. You know, all of these little things, he was really saying, I need to do this. So he chose to put himself in that situation. So I think self-directed learning during the teen years opens up all those kinds of possibilities for you to spend your time doing what makes sense for you, for your journey. And some of it will look academic and conventional, and some of it won't.
It sounds like the ability to make a lot of choices would be good for the development of their frontal lobe, I think.
Yes.
Like, as you're talking about, like, it encourages adulting at a younger age instead of, you know, the infancy that they're required to be in institutionalized school for so many years. And that was really designed to create good factory workers and the actual system.
Yes, so, exactly. And it also creates the other choice that they get to make is the choice to not choose. Like, you can choose to put yourself in a school so that you don't have to think about the different subjects. You just do what they've figured out. And that's really fair. Like, you might, you know, somebody wants to lose weight in their adult years. They can either like try to figure it out themselves, or they might choose to follow a weight loss program. So that's an awesome thing for us to know as adults, that we can do it ourselves, or we can choose to allow somebody else or some other concept to lead the way for it.
You're going to get more out of it if you're choosing.
Yep. But you don't have to make every little decision. You can choose to find somebody who's already done the research and just follow them. But you are choosing that. Therefore, you can choose to step aside if it's not feeling good anymore, or it's not working, or it's feeling stressful, or whatever it is.
What advice would you give to someone just starting out in homeschooling? I know it's hard to make it into a very small soundbite.
Well, if I had a one word answer, it would be de-school. Then the slightly more expanded would be get to the core of what you want for your kids, which is what I talked about with the heart, and get curious about how that plays out in your family. Also be aware of your context. One of the things I've created is like a Venn diagram where it's like what you want for your kids, what your context is, and where they overlap. That's what your homeschooling life is going to look like. So that's important to realize, that no matter how much you want to homeschool or unschool in a particular way, you may wind up not doing it exactly like that because of your context. I live in Quebec, and in Quebec, parents now have to register their kids who are homeschooling, and they have to follow the competencies of the provincial curriculum and do certain ministry tests and so on. So there's a compromise that, or something that people who are leaning towards unschooling have to work with. So that's the context piece, which is, it just makes your life easier to accept that you have a context, and that will inform how you do things as much as your desires inform how you do them. I'd also made the note of, you know, which we had talked about previously, of between the parents, it's so common that one partner is totally on board and one partner is not. And the frustration and the, like, that can be really, really hard. So recognize, again, accept that's hard. Both partners want the best for their children, and both partners might understand that to be something very different. So find your way to have those conversations. Maybe you're going to find somebody who can help you have that conversation. You know, one of the things that I've done a few times now is I've been hired by a couple. In most cases, they're separated, and they're trying to make a decision about their child's schooling. So I wind up being like an expert mediator, and that's a way of doing it. Hire someone to help you have the conversation. We talked about the idea of writing each other emails, which is what my husband and I wound up doing to figure it out. Be in contact with other families as well. And realize that some years you're going to have tons of homeschoolers around you, and it'll be a rich community. And other years, it might feel like everybody's disappeared and you're living on a desert island. If you're in it for the long haul, that pattern will probably happen. And again, that's something just to accept.
A friend of mine really wanted to homeschool her kids, but her husband didn't. He did provide a private school education for them that I think embodied quite a few of the values that she had and why she wanted to homeschool. So what she did is she just did what she called homeschooling, but, you know, I don't think it was that formal. So she just did that in the summers and when they were like not in institutionalized school, and that's how she got around it to do some of the things that she wanted to do in encouraging her kids' learning and still, you know, respecting the fact that her husband was not on board with it. And that was a compromise that they reached. And then they had a relative who was having a health issue, so she ended up homeschooling her youngest during that year, so that they could really look after that relative. too. So it was something that was always in her heart. And then it played out that way, which was a sad way, but a way that gave them no regrets in how they cared for their family member. And it was very special. So there are, because education is bigger than, you know, 8 to 3 or whatever, there are ways to go about those things. I mean, I could have a whole episode on how I gave myself a Charlotte Mason education when I was publicly educated, because when I wasn't at school, I read the classics and did nature study notebooking and all this kind of stuff. No one told me to do it, or, you know, but my parents provided book shelves and shelves full of books and library visits. And, you know, I got to be out in nature quite a bit because we had a very small house and a large family. So, you know, there's more than one way to do things.
Totally.
What was your worst moment or moments as a homeschooler?
So one of the hardest things was the lack of support from extended family, and because that played out for the kids as well. That was really hard. Also, the time that I mentioned at some point where my daughter's friends, they all went to middle immersion, grade 4. So it's like gone, disappeared. That was tough.
That happens at the high school age too. A lot of homeschoolers can homeschool up to the end of grade 8, and then suddenly they feel completely unconfident. And
for sure.
So then they stop. And I think that's when you almost need it more, but they do. Yeah. And then they kind of lose their friends because their lives don't connect in the same way anymore.
Exactly. Yep. And then another thing that was really hard was at the point where Julia went to school in grade 4, Oliver in grade 7, as I mentioned, for the Montessori year that he did. Leading up to that, it was so hard because I felt like we were no longer homeschooling, we no longer could wear that. I could no longer wear that hat. And it was so much a part of my identity. And that was also a really good moment because I understood self-directed learning then for the first time, that they were each choosing to go to school. And it wasn't that we were no longer a homeschooling family. It was that we were still a self-directed learning family who were currently showing that by both kids being at school. So that was, I guess, kind of the bad part of that was that sense of all of my identity being tied up in that, and the risks of that, putting all your eggs in one basket kind of thing.
I can relate to that. I did feel when I graduated from homeschooling, when my youngest went to a private high school, and then I did feel like, well, I'm a homeschooler, but here we are, you know, having him go there, which he wanted to do, and we totally supported it. I ended up becoming very involved in the school and being on the board and even doing guest appearances at chapel or in civics class or whatever, which was really fun. I'd like to do more of that. But and it was a lovely school and a small school, and the teachers super cared about the kids, and my son's learning really took off because he had other mentors that weren't just mom and dad. So it was great for him. But that feeling, because so much of your identity is in that. Yeah. Absolutely. But there's a bigger picture. There's a bigger picture, right?
And it gets defined in a different way. Like I said, I came to realize, we're self-directed learners. That's the value of our family. And right now they just happen to be at school. So that was, it was huge.
Yep. What was your best moment or moments in homeschooling?
I think the first moment that came to mind when I thought of this question, I have to requalify it as a pivotal moment, but it was good because it was so pivotal. And it was when I was teaching Oliver addition with regrouping. I had taught primarily grade 2 when I was a school teacher, and regrouping was something that was always very difficult to teach because everybody understood it in different ways and at different times, and it was a pain to teach it to a group. So I was like, yes, we're going to do this. I'm going to have like the best way. I've got the best analogy of the story. Like, it was so individualized. And we started doing it with my perfect lesson plan.
I shouldn't laugh, but
it's true, right? Perfect, like, in that moment, I was, you know, we were Like that was where my experience and mine was in that time. And it was like I could watch the spark fade and go out as he tried to connect his previously joyful playing with numbers to what I was trying to teach him. And thank goodness I had the presence of mind to say, let's go have a snack right in the middle of it. And I stopped to think about it. And that was my moment of realizing, wow, I don't have to teach anywhere near as much as I thought I did. There's so much that just comes out. And that it's when I started to understand playful learning and natural and all of that. So that was definitely a pivotal, wonderful moment. Overall, I loved having agency in the lives of the kids, being able to choose who they spent time with, the teachers for school or, you know, this history thing, all the awesome learning and living experiences that they got to have, you know, that we could go on holiday in September when it was quieter.
And more affordable.
Yeah. And then the moments when it was validated externally, you know, one parent one time to me said, I hope you don't mind, but I really use your son as like a model to my child because he's just so well balanced. And, you know, they might not realize that that's because he's a homeschooler and he's had all these experiences, but I knew it. When Oliver went to that Montessori school, they sat me down one day and said, we've had staff conversations about him because we all think that you have to go to school every day from kindergarten to grade six to get to where he is. But apparently you don't. So he's showing
that's sort of funny because one of the hallmarks of Montessori is self-directed learning. So it's very ironic that that's how they felt about it.
Yeah. So they were like, he's showing us a different way of thinking about education. So that was amazing. And then in university, when, you know, he's in his first year now, and I've asked him, what do you see as being the difference between you as a primarily homeschooled self-directed learner and your peers? Is there a difference? And he said, academically, no. But that one of the things he notices is that he's less tolerant of BS in the whole context. You know, they had like some clarity issues with profs who didn't have English as their first language, and exam questions were not worded clearly, and it was taking students time to figure out what was being asked. They were losing marks. Oliver was the one who contacted the department and found a solution. And it turned out that this was the first course that these professors hadn't had all of their writing double checked by a native English speaker. And so the university said, well, we're going to go back to having somebody else read it before the students get to it. So that kind of thing, that he knows how to advocate for himself and he can see something and say, this doesn't make sense. It's not right. And we can do something about it. That makes me super proud.
Oh, yes. You should be very proud. So if you could leave our listeners with a thought or piece of advice, what would that be?
Start the practice of noticing when your child or when you yourself is learning in a self-directed or self-motivated way. So that thing I kept talking about when your baby's ready to start rolling over, just get in the habit of noticing that.
It's amazing how they start doing crunches. Like they just randomly start doing tummy crunches.
Yep. So notice that. Don't point it out to your kids because they don't need to be conscious of it yet, but just notice it because that's going to be a big part of building the trust you want to have as a homeschooling parent. And get curious about what happens when you step back and give your kids more autonomy, when you don't try to lead the way or help them or facilitate, when you just step back one more step than you were going to, and then maybe one more step the next time. Just get curious. And all of that will help you as you move through the journey of parenting and homeschooling or whatever that winds up looking like for you. It'll help you to know what your baseline is, what your core is, where your decisions come from, and where your parenting and your guidance of your kids and your ability to be with them and help them to thrive, where that starts and where it goes from there.
That's a perfect place to finish, I think. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast again, Stephanie.
It's been a real pleasure. I really appreciated the open-endedness of the conversation, of the questions, of the time. I have no idea what time it is. We've probably talked for hours.
I don't care what time it is. Thank you so much. That's the beauty of it, because we're just having so much fun talking about things that we care about and
Yep.
Hopefully our listeners will enjoy the time that we've spent together.
Yep. I love having these conversations because what I see, you know, when I'm speaking or working with people and I see the lights that start going on and the changes that happen as people start to open up the way they think about childhood and education and learning and parenting. These are gifts to our world. So I love that I get to do this work. It's amazing. I'm so grateful.
Me too. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. You can find helpful links and show notes for this episode at our website, CanadaHomeschools.com. Please share this podcast with your friends and leave a rating and positive review on your podcast provider. This will help others find their dose of inspiration and encouragement. Happy homeschooling, Canada! Hee hee!